Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Morning, Gary.
Morning, Guy. I can actually hear you talking in the room next door.
No, I know. You've already complained bitterly. I've had 3 calls from reception and something in writing, actually.
Where are we?
We are in Lucerne with a bus that's broken down in Paris. So welcome to our world.
Yeah, you flew in yesterday from Paris.
I flew in yesterday. I left the bubble for a day to see family, which was really, really lovely. But it's so stressful. It's so stressful once you leave the family for your other family.
We took 3 trains to get here, but we were at least carrying your case. So if you never made it, I was going to put your case on stage.
He couldn't be here, but he sent his case.
It's
actually more animated than some bass players I can think of.
We're up in the sort of the Alps, aren't we? We're in the foothills of the Alps. We're in this strange hotel. They put us out of town, up by a ski lift, miles away from anything, including electricity, it seems. Now, I mean, in Switzerland, you need a special adapter that is only... Electricity only works in Switzerland with this use of this special plug. This is driving me mad. You had to find one at the airport for me, didn't you?
The airport was completely sold out of Swiss adapters. Luckily, my driver managed to stop at the Pearl Jam gig on the way to the hotel and get some adapters from their production crew.
Really? Really? So,
yeah.
My God.
I've got Eddie Vedder's adapter.
Swiss adapter.
That's my claim to fame.
So right now, Eddie Vedder can't record his podcast because of us.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got William Orbit on. You must have met William Orbit. You've met everyone, Guy.
I've only met him once. There's quite a funny story, which hopefully will come up, which is to do with him actually doing a remix for my late father-in-law, Rick Wright. But it's amazing slow burn of a career.
Yeah.
I say, until the 90s, and then it suddenly went... if ever there was an example of, man, just stick with it.
Yeah, because he's older than us. He's quite a few years older than us. And yet he didn't make it in the 80s. Although he did have a couple of really interesting sort of early electro, his band Torch Song.
Yeah, no, he was very cutting edge there. And there's a title, which we're obviously going to have to bring up.
And I suppose Bass-O-Matic was his first big hit. But obviously he's gone on to win Grammys with Madonna. And, he's worked with everyone, U2, and of course he did the Blur 13 album. And
13, which is a fantastic album. I mean, he had that real moment in the sun. And then it's very interesting what happens after that and how he's come back.
Yeah, and he's got a new album out called The Painter.
And all this will unfold. Let's get him on.
Welcome to The Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to 2 guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hi, William.
Hello. William, we're up in the mountains in the Alps because we're on tour. We're recording this end anyway.
Yeah, I'm recording my end too, Pro Tools, so... I've got a little road mic going on here.
Oh, brilliant. Well done. It's quite funny, William. We often find that the more technically minded, the more sort of producerial the guest we have, the less technical they are.
You're so right. You get asked, especially if your name is Orbit, it's like, oh, you know how to fix my hi-fi.
Your original fascination was tape recorders, wasn't it? Because there's something you said in a podcast, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. You said about the first time you saw a tape recorder was the idea of capturing keeping sound. I can't remember the actual phrase you used. Yeah. It was really good.
It was a revolutionary notion, and it was like discovering food, you know. It's like it's like little morsels of sound. And I drove my family nuts. I don't know, about eight, with this tiny tape recorder recording everything. Then I realised I need to actually have some content. It's all very well having the means, but you have to make content if you want people's interest.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because you just reminded me of when I was 11, I got given a Philips cassette recorder, 1971 this was, by Trevor Huddleston, the Bishop of Stepney. He'd heard me sing a couple of my songs at a prize giving at my school, and he liked what I'd written, and he brought this tape recorder around to the house. But one of the things I did on it with my friend was we recorded a play that we'd written. And I remember it was about rockets taking off. And the way to get a good rocket noise was I got my dad's radiogram, put the needle on the rubber and just turned it on. So it was going... and we spoke over it going, you know, Houston, come in, Houston, beep. But that fascination of being able to put things down on tape was, it felt very modern, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, they did have them at schools. And I do remember there was somebody, there was a teacher with a tape recorder, but they were big old things and there's no way you could ever take one home. But yeah, it was fascinating. And yeah, it's interesting. I was just setting up the mic and that's a good explosion, actually. All that microphone noise.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever cut up tape?
I did, but I used Sellotape, which is a mistake because it starts to ooze out the sides, the glue, and it gubbins up the gubbins, as it were.
Wow.
You know, there's special tape for it, you know, that you buy. But I got really good at it. You wouldn't see my hands move. It's a skill set that's thoroughly defunct.
When you got into studios, did you have that? So, because I always remember the first time you were in a recording studio, seeing someone edit tape, you just think, oh my God, that is, it's like being a bomb disposal expert or something. It seems like the most terrifying thing to do.
But yeah, editing 24-track tape, definitely. Get it wrong and you're buggered. But I actually remember coming back when I was an 8-track studio and we'd been to our first 24-track session. And there was this big, fat, wide 2-inch tape in a box and I felt very important putting that on the shelf. It's like, yeah, this is proper.
Let's not go back too soon. I want to talk about...
Yeah, the painter.
Yeah, it's some beautiful stuff on here, William. I also saw your clip on Jules Holland doing the Colours track the other day. And she's an extraordinary singer you have there.
I know, there's something about her voice. I mean, she's unique. There's certain singers that are, you know, there's nobody else in the world that sounds remotely like them, and she's one of those singers. And she's quite nervous.
Remind me of her name.
Polly Scattergood.
Polly Scattergood. How could I forget such a
fantastic
name?
Fantastic name.
And she's been a mute records for most of her career. And, yeah, she was quite nervous. But when I was there behind her and she hit that kind of chorus, I had shivers. You know, it was terrific. I really enjoyed that show. It's really fun, actually. Jules is great. We've met before years ago, but he does this, make it look so easy. It's very balletic. It's very choreographed, the way they do it in this room, you know, with this crane, doing the crane shots. But also, all the musicians had a tremendously good time. You can tell.
Well, because everyone loves playing in front of their peers. I mean, that's why I loved it. And the fact that it starts with that jam thing, you know, of everyone just playing together.
Yeah, everybody dancing to each other's tracks, hanging out. It was this sweet. And it was at Alexandra Palace in, you know, this totally derelict, unreconstructed play. I mean, I used to break in and play as a child to this theatre. And there was great lumps on the floor where the floor had kind of buckled up. And the crane operator, and they weren't used to the crane. It was a new thing, these crane shots. This gigantic thing. I mean, it's huge and it takes, what, 5 operators. And they had to steer around all these warps in the floor because if they hit one, the whole thing would just wobble.
Oh, wow.
And I thought it was magnificent. When you've been in the recording and then you watch it back, you think, wow, there's more going on here than I realised. They make it look easy.
Yeah.
It's superb.
Were you a bit nervous about taking what is, you know, a very studio sound, especially, say, on her voice, you know, the effects that you put on, and making that work not only live, but given TV producers and mixers dealing with it?
Well, the sound team, first of all, you get your own desk. Each artist gets their own setup, which is terrific. So there's a chance to really perfect it. And the guy that did the sound and the monitor guy came to a little rehearsal we did. So I was very confident that these are the best of the best. So I wasn't really worried about that. TV sound is better these days.
I was going to say, the BBC have come a long way, haven't they?
Gosh, yes. Yeah, I mean, there's a guy, the Bob Nettles, who does a lot of their classical work as well. I've been in sessions with him on his digital desk, and it doesn't get any better than that. You know, these people are probably the creme de la creme of recording people for live radio, so I wasn't worried.
The journey for you coming towards this album is, you know, which I've read about, is quite extraordinary. Your tale and your honesty and the sense of maybe artistic redemption that it's brought you.
Yeah, I can't quite believe it, actually, because it's, you know, emerged from what was the worst time in my life, when music wasn't even an option, to what is now a really jolly good time. I'm enjoying life generally, and the creativity, and being so busy. Because when you make a record and you're just, it's, you know, a solo artist, essentially, along with his guests, there's a lot to do. And if you're doing the visuals as well, it's a lot to do. You know, it's videos and animations and so forth, i.e. one is very busy. But it's stuff that's fun to do. I go to bed every night thinking, I can't wait to wake up and crack on with what I'm doing. It's very nice.
What went wrong, and what sort of things, in a way, you had to sort of hit the bottom to approach this album?
Well, I could say it was a sort of perfect storm of events, some of which, of course, I brought upon myself, some of which was just life throwing awful curveballs as it can. And then I took drugs and I was not taking care of myself. So all these things combined. And I had this, it wasn't that so much. It was just that I had this, I think, false impression of who I was. I just worked out who I am, and I don't like it at all. And I felt really, really pointless. And it was quite horrible, dreadful, actually. And then I sort of had a change of heart. Something happened, and that, including some amazing friends. And one thing leads to another. And I don't intend to come off this now. I figured it out. There's no reason to go there again, regardless of what happens. You know, it's sort of almost like, it's like being yourself 2.0. At my late age, you know, it's like you can steer away from stuff.
I kind of know what you mean. And I don't mean to sound glib in any way, William, but I mean, is it almost, because it's before you went through sort of this big episode of discovering drugs and everything, it's like is it almost like you had to go through something massively cathartic to bring yourself back to?
Well, you know, there is that sort of everything for a purpose that we tend to sort of retrospectively attach to events, you know, to try and... So we don't question it too much, otherwise you drive ourselves nuts, because a lot of it is random. It's a stochastic process as much as anything else. But the actual answer is yes, it had to be. You couldn't possibly be in the state that I'm in now, having not gone through that. So that's a paradox, isn't it? I don't regret anything. I wouldn't change it, because it's in the past. There's no need to change it. You're not living in the past. But I wouldn't wish it upon
anybody.
That's brilliant.
That's job done, because it's because regret is the thing that kills you.
Yes, indeed. I wouldn't wish it upon anybody in their own path to happiness and creative satisfaction. I mean, there are other ways. But in my case, fortunately, it turned out okay. And I don't want to sound glib or smug, but it came all right. So I'm very happy.
But because in normal jobs, in everyday life, people get their job and they retire at 65. And then you get the gold watch and people say, thank you very much. You've done a brilliant job. Off you go to the sunset. In our lives, in our jobs, in artistic jobs, the first person to think, oh my God, I'm not wanted anymore, is ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I think we've all experienced that. And it comes at a much younger age. And it doesn't necessarily come at an age where we have finished, you know. It's just that we all go through times when our career doesn't look or feel as good as it should be. You've managed to come out of that, but part of what made you hit the bottom was that terrifying notion that maybe I'm not worthy anymore.
Yeah, I just feel like this wall of indifference is like a, you know, like the Berlin Wall. It gets more and more resolute as, you know, because the Berlin Wall was just a bit of concrete, wasn't it? Some slabs and some barbed wire, and then of course people would cross it and they would dig tunnels, so they found all these ways of stopping tunnels and tanks and people climbing over, and the wall got tougher and tougher until people were resigned to the fact they were going to have to stay in East Berlin. And that was similarly with my feeling of like rebuffment, if you like. It was getting more and more a wall through which I just couldn't penetrate. But I was misguided about that, and of course you have to work hard as well. You have to put in you have to work, got to do stuff. And it's harder when you're older.
I would say, William, there is a thing with you, because you were actually very, very fortunate compared to a lot of people in our business, in that I'm sure it didn't feel like it at the time, but in retrospect, because your career, you know, you had your first deal in, 1980 or whatever, and you have this sort of slow burn through the 80s with, you know, Pastor Massey and all that. There's all sorts of stuff I want to get to. But then it like went bam in the mid-90s. So you'd actually had a much nice, longer, slower run what I mean is a lot of people who do what we do were done by the time you hit.
I think I got quite used to and comfortable in the slow burn zone. I mean, that was my thing. Yeah. Periods of, yeah, I'd get frustrated, but I always realised I felt like an outsider, even in my own country. I've never had any British sort of, never got Brit or anything. And I've always felt a bit like not part of the prevailing wave, to my frustration and then later to my relief. So this slow burn, you know, and tracks, albums that come out and don't really garner much attention, but they're still around 20 years later. That was my thing. It's like, this is okay, I can do this. So when the big boom came along with Madonna, you know, it was triggered that in 97, 98, I didn't know how to handle it. And that threw me off kilter, really. And I sort of had a slow decline ever since. Because, you know, this thing about retiring at 65, you know, sports, if you're a footballer, you know, you've got to retire much younger than that. And if you're a pop musician, it's sort of the same thing. It's a very young game. If you want to stick around, you have to be a producer or in jazz or in classical. You know, you can't always be, you know, selling the youth thing that is such an attractive thing. And we love that, the sound of youth. The look of youth is very alluring, but it passes. And so if you're in that game, you have to think, well, oh, I didn't realise how easy things were back then. It's because I was young and pretty, you know. It's like the same thing now isn't so easy. And it's like, well, that's because you're not a young flower anymore. So, but you have to put a lot of work in. But it's also, oh, I don't know. I do think of myself as still younger. So when I see I've been on telly a couple of times recently due to this record coming out. I mean, I was on Channel 4 News for a little, and I was looking at myself thinking, God, I look like an old guy. My eyes are all wonky. I've got loads of luggage under my eyes, you know, a whole set of Louis Vuitton building up there. Are people going to go, what an old dude? What's he got to do with anything? And then I resigned myself to the fact, well, you know, you don't have to look at it. Just listen to it. Listen to it, because that doesn't have anything to do with age whatsoever. It's now. For me, it's very fresh.
You're also growing up with your audience. I mean, I suppose part of the problem was you came from a style of music that is about the clubs, and people only tend to go to clubs when they haven't got kids and when they're young and single. Mm-hmm. But that music, especially with this new album, has matured into something that is, you play at home. You know, you can listen to it. It is a form of modern classical in a way. It's textured, it's layered, it has more depth than just a dance track. It's not house, or it's not just techno. And you introducing thoughtful artists into that mix, like Beth Orton, you know, like some of the talking parts that happen on this new record. That is a sense of finding an adult way of doing this.
I wanted it to be thoughtful. Thank you for pointing that out. And I wanted it to be quite reassuring as well, because it's reassured me, and I wanted that to translate. And I also wanted it to be a very satisfying listen on headphones. I mean, I mixed most of it on headphones, to be honest, and to yield up its secrets slowly, you know. And I didn't do the whole thing over the course of the 18 months, you know. I used material as well from previously that I had in my deep archives, so that there was a sense of continuity going back, and also sonically, because all the old stuff was done on tape, you know, with that Valve gear and all that.
Oh, yes. I've still got all my Strange Cargo albums.
So I keep squeaking. This squeak is actually a pen that I'm twiddling, so I'll put it down. But it's also a very...
A mouse that I'm torturing as
I'm squeaking. Actually squashing a mouse. No, actually, that's outside. You know, squirrels are really loud. At my balcony here, because I live on a square, but there's a squirrel. That's his territory. I mean, I'm here as a guest, and he's very aggressive. He's very urban. He's like a gangster squirrel, and he's got a very shifty look. Because in the countryside, they just hop around and look like out of a Beatrix Potter book. But in town, they're very intimidating, these squirrels.
No, we've got the same. We've got a squirrel, and we are absolutely on his manor.
Yeah. They're loud, aren't they, as well? They're very loud.
Yeah.
I've seen them in the park, you know, like seagulls. They've learned to be kind of proactive, to get their run up people's chests, you know, to get the food. I've seen tourists go, oh, look, a squirrel. Next thing you know, there's children are screaming.
Okay. Enough of squirrels. I just want to ask this question then. What was the key for you to escape the bottom? Well, I've read it was art, wasn't it? Painting?
It was art, yes. You know, about 5 years ago, I started doing art. But the real key as well is actually technology. The how-to bit, you know, the geeky stuff, just learning new toys, new tricks, because you could always learn stuff, you know, on Pro Tools and Logic. But my happy place is also art, and digital art too. I just love to do art, and I love to do it digitally or with a paintbrush. I don't ever listen to music when I'm doing art. I'm just fiendishly engrossed in books, audiobooks, or podcasts. You know, the two sit very well. It's nothing, you know, in a couple of times in my life, I've been laboriously fixing, doing some housekeeping on a track and trimming off bits of clicks and or something like that. And I know it's going to take 2 hours and I might put on some radio as I do it, but that's the extent of it. Yeah, that's 0.001 of the music making time. Music making is very immersive. You know, there's nothing else. It's like that when typically, everybody knows this one, you've got headphones on, you're deeply immersed and somebody comes along to offer you a cup of tea and you leap out of your seat. If you're with somebody gently rocking away on their Logic Audio or the Ableton with headphones on, sort of walk slowly in front of them so they can see you. Because if you just tap them on the shoulder, the normal reaction you'd get was, yep, it can be very shocking to be brought out of that immersive deep state, hypnotic. But for art, it's the opposite. And you can have the two streams, if you like, completely functional at the same time. So that's a double bonus, double dividend. Fantastic.
Well, it's funny because the last guest we had on was my old mate Youth, the producer. And when I've worked with him, he'll usually be painting something or while the session's going on.
Well, doodling is great too, because when you doodle, you know, anybody doodles and you've got a piece of paper and a pad and you're not even thinking, you're just concentrating on the dialogue and the discourse. You're totally there in the conversation. So your hand is doing something you're not even thinking about. It's always worth looking at what you doodled.
Just give your doodles to a psychiatrist and he'll tell you exactly where you're at.
No, put your doodles on an album sleeve and see, and that'll tell you what you're really at. That's more like it.
Well, you know, Nick Mason, who we're working with, you know, he did his doodles all over the, you know, he made the Relics album sleeve. A lot of artists, a lot of musicians turn to art as well, don't they? I mean, Bowie does art, I mean, Paul McCartney does art.
Yeah, Captain Beefheart.
Well, Captain Beefheart, he actually said, didn't he, when he became an artist, he said, I've been cured of music.
But he was a man for a perverse statement, though, anyway. Contrarian. I mean, what about Blue? Joni Mitchell as well. I mean, she's a very sought-after artist.
Bob Dylan.
I mean, the only thing is, if you're stamped as a musician, you know, there's automatically, oh, you're a Sunday painter. Well, I don't care. I know the art world in London and in the US to a degree. I know there's people. I've got many friends. And I would never try and claim to be in that world. I don't speak the lingo, nor do I see myself seriously. Yeah. I just love to do it. And I like it. It's pretty. You know, I haven't got paragraphs of exposition about it all. It's like I've got nothing to say about it. There it is.
I think that not having two jobs thing, I have to say, is quite a British thing. In America, it's much more acceptable to, if you're any kind of artist, you can try different mediums.
I think it's perfectly okay to be a musician and have several other jobs. You know, I like to multitask. I love it. I like things when they also don't connect. You know, when you're doing something that has nothing relevant to your creative work. I love that. I find it very stimulating to be in circles where music is, everybody's interested in the creative arts, but it's not what anybody does.
Can we ask you about who William Orbit was as a young man and how he discovered music and who he was into?
I'm just in the process of my Italian passport application because I'm going to be living in Italy, and I had to sort of dig back a bit to everything. You know, I was born in 1956, you know, which, you know, that gives it away, in a very different world to teachers. But I really wanted to be creative, but I didn't actually know how to really do it properly. I mean, messing around with tape recorders, but as a professional, it didn't happen until I was 23. And I left school at 15/16, so it was a long time coming. But when it did happen, it was like all in, totally all in. That was all I wanted to do. It's all I've ever, you know, that's how I earn my living, you know, through thick and thin.
Yeah, but it was a classical background, wasn't it, that you come from? This is well known. But were you drawn to that? Did you love that? Did you want to play classical music?
I've spoken to other musicians who are the same, and they said that at school and at home, they rebelled against being taught piano or recorder. You know, they hated it and made it clear to their parents and to their teachers, and often saying maybe misbehaved in music classes because they were so boring. These days, it's different. I mean, they're wised up now.
Absolutely.
With children. It's like, come on, play children stuff they love until they're literally busting you to get an instrument in their hands rather than try and force your own stuff onto them. But in those days, and I hated it, so... Sorry, what was the question again?
Yeah, happens to us all. Where are we? The fact that you had this classical background...
Oh, yes. I loved it, and I did adore it. Quite an eclectic classical range. I mean, my parents were obsessed with Benjamin Britten, so there was all of that, Peter Pierce. But they were also obsessed with Schubert and Mozart, and I, to this day, you know, every note of some of those Mozart, the clarinet, concerto, sinfonia, concertante, you know, in my head. I can sometimes, for my own sort of entertainment, I perform it for myself in my head, every note. I try to sing it too, but that doesn't work. So I'm very happy with that, but Then I discovered pop music, you know, and it was, whoa, like bass. I can't remember being so enthralled by it because my father had bought a hi-fi, like people did. That's what dads did.
Can you remember what it was? Can you remember what the hi-fi was?
It was a Goldring Lenco.
A B&O?
No, it wasn't B&O. It was Goldring Lenco. Oh. Was the an English speakers. Big speakers, big sound. I mean, he just wanted to blast Vivaldi at the top volume. And of course, stereo came in just after. So he had all these records of a train passing a crossing, you know, and he would sit there and listen to it going from left to right. So when I finally got some recordings of pop music, like Jimi Hendrix, for instance, or reggae, on my little tape recorder and plugged it in to the system, it was like, wow, what makes bass? What is it? I didn't know. I remember the day I first discovered bass. There's not exactly a lot of bass in classical music. Not sustained, deep, throbbing bass. I mean, no, you know, you do get some great bass notes when all the double basses do a pizzicato at the same time, but that's not the same.
Timpani tends to throw out the most impressive bass frequencies. And
but there's like another octave. There's another floor below, you know, that comes off the bass guitar, you know, especially in... Because reggae, well, it's known for its bass. And I did somebody explained to me once that the reason why the bass is so satisfying is because those studios in the 70s in, say, Jamaica... very cheap, homemade, you know, with egg boxes on the wall, largely. And they record musicians pretty much live as a band before they put the vocals on. So all the mics are open and all the the bass is bouncing, you know, booming out of its own cabinet, but it's all picking up on all the other mics and all the other sort of, you know, the vocal mics and whatnot, instruments. And they didn't filter it out. So there's this, the bass is spread around the entire recording in a very sort of ecological way that gives you that warmth. And... so,
but bass is interesting because on vinyl you can't get as much bass bottom end because the needle will jump out of the groove if you cut too much bass. And it's funny that techno music and dance music, where bass became such a huge thing, it was given its place because of the digital recording world and the fact that things were coming out on CDs and you could get more bass on CD.
That's why it was around 1989 that we all had to get 5 strings. Suddenly all bass players had to have a 5-string. And after a few years, you realise that's actually kind of rubbish. But it was that thing of, because you were trying to compete with bass synths. Everyone was playing an octave lower.
I know. I remember going on tour with Bass-O-Matic, and we were supporting a band. It was Seal's band. And I know there was a bit of frustration on the part of Seal and his band because we'd been on stage and I'm playing stuff off of decks. I've got synths going and bass is solid. And then, you know, it just felt a bit lighter after that. Not their fault, but that was, you know, an advantage of... But that's the thing with vinyl. I mean, you've got a wide stereo spread, all being determined by these two sides of the valley, if you like, cut into the plastic, which is amazing. But the bottom end, you can't... below a certain frequency, you think about that needle's moving slower for those slower frequencies, you can't put the bass out of phase on either side because you're asking the needle to be in two places at the same time, you know, which is great in quantum physics, but not for needles. So, you know, you have to sort of remember all that kind of thing. If the vinyl's running fast, you get more like 45s, you know, you get better bass than on the 33, and it's all very much bass manipulation. Whereas now, as you say, you can put the bass...
And tape speed as well, wasn't it? Because like Adrian Sherwood always used to record at half the speed.
The slower the tape, the better the bass.
You lose all the top. Yeah, you get all the bass.
There's some pure physics in that, you know, that explains that. It's not just subjective. Of course, yeah, with digital, you can have the bass out of phase, whatever you like. You know, it doesn't matter because nothing's going to crank out.
There's a friend of mine, James Wiltshire, who was in the Freemasons. He now does all these audio packs. But he gave me a timeline of the history of bass frequencies and how basically to do with nightclub sound systems and stuff. There was a thing that happened in the mid-90s when the bass floor went down, it like doubled. And then another thing happened in the early 2000s when the bass floor doubled again, which is why you now have this infinite capacity for bass. So, which is why there's this terrible thing, which is if you're in a club and you're listening to some sort of new banging track and it's fine, but then you put on Chic and suddenly you've got this, the most magnificent dance record you've ever heard, but it hasn't got that bottom. You know, because they just didn't physically have it.
That's a good point, actually. I mean, I know you can have all the floors. You know, they have floors, don't they? How many bigger places that vibrate? The floor's a giant bass boom. But yeah, of course, if it's not there, there's nothing you can do about it.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm going to mention that track, Ray of Light, which always gets mentioned. People like to hear it, but it always sounds very thin to me. You know, there's no bottom end on it. It's a rock track, if you like, really.
But what were you thinking at the time? What were you trying to do at the time?
Show off, basically. I was showing off. I did start with the techno beat, you know, like a 909 type of sound, but it was all, I mean, it was the jammiest of jammy as in an improvisational sense, and jammy as in lucky as well. But it was a jam. I was showing off in the studio with the guitar and the synths, and Madonna was showing off with what she could do, and it was very spontaneous. And didn't want to fix it. That was it. You know, the vibe is terrific as it is. Let's not try and cut it up and turn it, make it too neat and posh. It works. So that was a very kind of off-the-cuff track, which for her is unusual.
Where did it come from then? Come on, for our listeners.
Well, I was working with this singer called Christine Leach, and she had this uncle who'd written this folk song and sadly passed away. And I put on this amazing beat, and she starts, you know, what shall I sing now, William? Well, I don't know, what have you got in your sort of rag bag of songs? I thought she was writing it, but it was actually, she was sort of singing this folk tune into the track. And it's like, this is great. And it was still very rudimentary. It wasn't by any means what you hear now with Ray of Light, but it was enough that when Madonna heard it, she jumped on it and said, yeah, let's take this further.
How did she hear it? That's the thing. How did she hear it?
How do you mean, how did, with my ears? How do you mean, how did I hear it?
No, how did Madonna hear it?
He must have had the job by then, I'm guessing.
Yeah, no, I'd done the recording.
Oh, you had the job. Okay.
She wasn't even in my horizon when I did it. I did what I thought was going to be Strange Cargo 5, I suppose, next to my cassette. So I did Strange Cargo 1, 2 and 3. Then I did Hinterland, which is essentially Strange Cargo 4. Yeah. Couldn't call it that because it was a contractual thing. And then this was going to be Strange Cargo 5 on Warners. And it just didn't really click for Warners. And it ended up being her, Madonna, listening to it. And she just was on the phone the next day, basically, and said, come and let's do this. And then we did it. A tiny little, well, not tiny, but a quite intimate studio in Burbank, which is part of the kind of greater Los Angeles area. Very far away from all the fancy LA bits.
Well, I know, because I used to work with her at Pat Leonard's studio, which is in Burbank.
Yes. Well, and Pat was involved. And Pat was involved. So I met up with Pat and he wrote Frozen. And it's very convenient because we were never bothered by anybody. Nobody ever came round. It's very intimate. And we were there for some months.
William, I just wanted to go back a little bit to when you first got introduced to Madonna. And if, because she was such a big star and she's a very powerful star, was there a sense of, wow, I can't believe I've got this job, I'm not worthy? Or was there a certain level of fear and insecurity in approaching how to work with this person?
There wasn't fear, but there was a lot of wow. I mean,
did she phone you up first?
She did.
Because my first ever conversation with Madonna was she called me up at 4 a.m. and went, I hear you're funny, make me laugh.
She's got a weak spot for humour. I mean, that's the way to diffuse any, because you can get a bit tense, you know, with a
I found that.
But if you kind of find the funny bone, it resets. It's, you know, it's like, and she loves that. And she's funny. She's a comedian herself.
But how was it writing with her? How was that approach? Did you feel confident?
I got the call. You know, I got the call. A friend of mine took it. He said, you know, this friend of mine is very chill out to the dude. He's a bit of a stoner. And he picks up and he says, hey, William, it's Madonna. It's like, all right. You know, and she tells me, you know, discuss what is. And she said, would you like to come out and try out some stuff? And then before we actually went into the Hit Factory for 5 days, I went around to her apartment on the park. So she's living a couple of apartment blocks from that big one where the film with Mia Farrow, what's it called? Poltergeist? No. What's the film?
Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, that famous apartment block. I forget the name. John Lennon lived there as well. And hers is...
The Dakota.
So she's a couple of blocks up from the Dakota, and it was very impressive. And I arrived there, and it was a beautiful apartment. Of course, it had a gym and bowls of candy everywhere. And it was a rainy day in New York, and I turned up a bit drenched and was, you know, I was in... very taken aback, because immediately we were talking about music. It wasn't like, oh my God, you know, I'm around a pop star. I've never been particularly, I mean, people fascinate me. Anybody fascinates me, including pop stars and famous people, because they're usually famous and for a reason, because they're fascinating, but they don't have to be a pop star. I just like interesting people. So that's my level of engagement already. It's very tuned in. But soon we're talking about music and stuff and the tracks and practicalities. And it's like, this is going to be great. And we did the recording subsequently, and at the end of the 4 or 5 days, it had gone very well. And I remember she came in with her little baby, Lola, and she said, "Well, we'll go, William. You'll hear from my manager to arrange the nuts and bolts of it all in the studio, but we're on." And of course, she went, and everybody in the studio, and it wasn't, the engineer and the tape op and the assistant all kind of were going, as she walks out the door and she's gone, it's like, "Wow, William, no idea." And I was so pleased. And I said this before, but when I was in the plane going back, I felt like I was flying the plane. It didn't need petrol. My own energy was taking the jumbo jet back.
That's beautiful. Did you produce her vocally, though? How did you have to have that job?
Well, I did. But also I had help with that, especially initially with an engineer called Pat McCarthy, who was fantastic. He already knew her.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful guy. Yeah. Wonderful man. I mean, just so good. I learned so much from him. And he had a really special way. And there's another engineer, Dave Reitzis, an American guy who was a bit more mainstream, worked with all the divas. Well, these guys knew the ropes. I've always recorded vocals. I've always loved recording vocals. I've always taken great care on the recording and on what happens afterwards. But it was good to have their expertise, especially at the outset, because we were in a whole different level of technology, mics that cost tens of thousands of pounds and Madonna, you can't get this wrong.
Yeah.
So I did have help. But I know how to record vocals.
Half the tracks I've done with her, her vocal has actually just been the guide she did in the control room while the band were putting the track down. I mean, stunning.
And the thing is, when you get her...
Stunning.
A typical process, the standard, if you like, is to record three passes, pass A, B and C, and then you go and comp it together. And it usually the first take or the second take is the one, and you pop a couple of syllables in from others because we don't mess around. There was no auto-tune, there's no, none of that, not a thing. It's just like, this is... it, every singer can hit a note that's not quite on. Well, one of the other takes will be fine. We pop it in. That's comping. Never take long. But I remember Pat Leonard saying to me when we were on take two, and this is when she's doing the hums for Frozen, the humming section. And she does it once, she does it twice. And Pat says, "That's the gold. That's the money. When she does it twice, then you can hear that super, super rich golden sound she's got." There's no technology involved, there's nothing, just twice her singing it. And with my experience with singers is that if you really want to get a good double track, they don't hear themselves when they're doing each version, so there's more kind of variation, because some singers can get very perfect, so they sing it again and it's just, it's too much the same. So but no, with Madonna it's hard work. It's quite stressful doing the comps because she works at such a pace and you can't zone out. You've got to be utterly on it. The normal rules of making music, when you can kind of be zoning in and out, as you go along, don't apply. You've got to be like flying a plane. You've got to be right on it. So it's quite hard work, but not difficult with her. Never difficult. She's an excellent, she's technically one of the most accomplished singers I've ever worked with, especially at that point in her career, as well as the fact she's another person with a voice that you can never mistake. It's Madonna. You know it.
I was going to say, because you and I actually, we met when you were doing 13 round at Damon Albarn's house.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Yeah. I was probably very drunk. But yeah, because you were quite keen to know what my experience of Madonna was. You really wanted to compare notes.
I'm keen to know now.
Well, I was just playing bass. So probably the proudest thing of my career, which is like a prayer. So,
I'll make a point of listening to that after we're done. And
it's the space in the middle section and the end section, which is insane. I still can't believe I was allowed to do it.
Wow. How did that come about?
I knew Pat. I knew Pat Leonard I met him through working with Brian Ferry and then through Pink Floyd. And he used to get me in on everything. Wow. So, which was fantastic.
I just wanted to wrap up on Madonna, really, because you worked with her for 20 years, right up to sort of... MDNA or that the last later albums with her music and how that pressure built over that period of time with her as well as fashions came and went. Did you sense the pressure building?
I'm very aware that she is very clued into the zeitgeist, and I run on my own kind of zeitgeist, if you like. And in music, she discovered this amazing guy, this French guy, Mirrorways. And I, at the time, didn't go there aesthetically. So that caused a bit of a musical divergence. I mean, it wasn't unfriendly or anything, but I could sense she wanted to, she fell in love with his sound, so, as did I, and wanted that. So it's been on and off. I would love to do something kind of more organic and fractal with her at some point. I'm sure we will. But, well, she's done some remix album, which is actually fantastic. I sense that once that's out of the way, there's another Madonna record coming, because she'll never stop. I mean, she's a musician. At the end, you know, you only have got to look at her face when she's in the studio. It's like, that's her happy place, and she's just what she does. You know, I mean, all the rest of it, at the end of the day, a core thing is music, and she's so good at it. So she'll be in a studio making more records. Whether I'm involved or not, I don't know. It just might be me just getting a call saying, oh, William. She's a bit naughty like this, because I know I've had calls from her and say, God, these people are just rookies. I don't know, William. I kind of be like you and all kind of communicate properly. And like, well, I'm sure they're fine, Madonna, but I know full well that she's done that exactly the same thing about me. And she's just told me I'm just useless and rung up. You know, she'll bring Rick Rubin in one day just to sort of say, William, you're getting a bit sloppy. Here's Rick, you know. So she does that a little bit. But I wish her well. I hope she makes a record that she's super happy with. That's the key.
Because the modern experience with producing is a bit of a patchwork quilt, isn't it? Where you've got other producers doing different tracks, and there isn't a way nowadays of saying, you know, I'm going to produce the whole album. It's a concept.
I know. And of course, you know, it can work. I mean, I really like that last Dua Lipa album. I think there are lots of producers involved. I don't know who helmed that in A&R terms, but they did a bang-up job. But the thing about Ray of Light, it was timely because it was CDs, it was albums, it wasn't. There was no separate track purchase like Spotify and stuff. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, when a single came out, you could buy it, but you couldn't just buy a track off an album. You bought the CD if it was an album track.
That's right, yeah.
And so coupled with the fact that she absolutely kept everybody from the label that day, nobody ever came from Warner's. The only people that came to visit were Rick Rubin or something, and some of her friends and family, but it was no pros came, and you could do that then. For starters, it couldn't leak. For second, it was a CD thing. For thirdly, we're very isolated. And fourthly, the market wasn't that kind of market. Could you do the same now? I believe you can, but you'd have to be very determined, i.e. make an album that is one producer, one artist, one set of people, one studio. Best is to go somewhere and book a residential place for 2 months and lock the doors, I think. But you've got to be very careful with stuff leaking. You know, it's a different world.
We should talk about Blur.
Talk about an album that is like done in a traditional way. We really went and did it like an old-fashioned way. We recorded the tape. We partied a lot. The band played everything. And the band were the band. There was nobody came as a guest producer or guest performer, apart from the choir.
The choir, yeah, on Tender, which is, of course, is magnificent.
Oh, we did that. No, did we do that in Iceland? We did the choir in London. And we were instructed by the choir master beforehand, no profanities, please. This is a not a secular choir, so keep the language tame. And I do think we tried our best not to profanitize, not to be profane. But we did some recording in Iceland, but most of it was just done in one little studio in Primrose Hill.
But it was famously a difficult album, wasn't it? The band was sort of breaking up or not getting on with each other. How was that for you? And also because you're not writing on this record as well. You're sort of serving Damon, really, aren't you?
Well, the latter aspect I relish. I like that. I like the same with you too. I mean, look, I get enough chance to write my own stuff or with other people. I love it when I'm just the producer. The difficulty was the fact that, you know, Damon and Graham were having some friction, shall we just say.
Graham was going through stuff at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah. And that happened. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't as if we were going through stuff, but let's put it, you know, while we're doing tracks, while we're recording, let's put it to one side and just get on with it. It pervaded every aspect of the recording. And so I did find myself getting quite tired out from the diplomacy involved. Plus, I wasn't a smoker at the time. I mean, I've always been an on-off smoker in my life, unfortunately. But at the time, I wasn't smoking. And they were puffing away like mad. And I remember gasping. But I did enjoy it very much. But it was quite difficult with the psychology of it all, the diplomacy.
Because Damon was actually in the middle of a bit of a lost weekend, wasn't he? He'd moved into a flat with Jamie Huner on Westbourne Grove.
He just split up with his
girlfriend. And it was just this non-stop party flat. Yeah. I only lived about 100 yards away. And that's where I met you, William. Because it was just all going on there all the time. And I was thinking, hang on, they're making an album in the middle of all this.
I can remember rolling up there on a very bright sunny day to the studio in a taxi to Primrose Hill, because I was in St John's Wood at the time, and we'd been drinking the night before, and as I passed the doorway of this shop, there's Alex asleep in the doorway. He's been up all night. And Damon would get very excitable, you know, because when Damon's he's good, and he knows he's good, and he loves being good. And when he is, he gets very happy, and why not? And I can remember him charging up and down on the Neve mixing desk. I mean, You know, this is a grown man running up and down on a priceless old antique desk worth hundreds of thousands of pounds and, yeah. and well, enjoyed the moment, but also was like, who's liable for this? But no, it was good times.
But you were pushing them in a slightly different direction, it felt. Or was that Damien? I mean, how was your role between the two of you?
I think, on reflection, I think both of us were pushing in different ways. His writing, his arrangement skills, he was developing. And I was also developing. We were learning new techniques and things. Just to get a bit technical, I do apologise to you and your listeners if the audio coming from...
No, we love a bit. We love a bit. We love a bit of it.
Right. Yeah, I don't think you'll hear anything nasty. Oh, okay. It's a good old...
Sorry, I thought you were going to say something technical, which we like.
Well, there's that day when we got like 0.5 of the decibel up, the SMPTE code was 2.739 and about five phase and 180.
Stop it.
So exciting. I want to tell you all about it.
Stop it. You're turning us on.
And these walls are very thin.
I hear Swiss wine is very good.
We don't know. Guy and I are not drinking on the tour.
Oh, okay.
But you're right. I did used to drink Swiss wine. Right, really I used to terrible. Work in quite a lot. No, Swiss wine is actually very good, but they can't make very much of it, which is why you only ever get to have it
yes,
in Switzerland.
Yes, good point. Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think it's interesting that your background was so classical, because in a way you were sort of made for dance music in that sense, because the era that you became successful in was an era when the vocalist was probably less important and that it was about instrumentals, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's a good point.
Yes, the term instrumentals feels a little bit less loaded now. You know, it's like not just pop with the vital part missing. It's just as valid as any other form. Whereas in classical music, nobody would ever think to say, oh, this classical symphony is like an opera without the vocals. I mean, it's not a thing. No. And I think we're in an age now where it's also accepted. I believe in structure. I do believe in a very good melodic. Melody is king with everything. Everything has to sit right with the melody. You don't necessarily have to notice it. I don't want people to have to think about it. I'm very happy for people to think, that was a very pleasant piece of ambient music. I feel very chill now. But inside, they wouldn't necessarily know this at first listen, but there's a lot of sort of hidden sauce melodically, arrangement-wise. Every note's crucial. And the thing about classical music, and when I started to deconstruct it to do those pieces in the modern style records... I don't have any education. I don't read music. I've got this kind of dyslexia for that, so I do it by ear. And when you're listening to these composers that would have written the piece, you know, like 100 years ago, just on a piano, I mean, every note, there's no hiding place. Every note has to work over this course of this extended piece of music. I respect that deeply.
When you were doing pieces in a modern style, obviously you did Barber's Adagio for Strings, which was a huge hit for you in 1999. Did you hear your dad speaking to you, going, you can't do this to this music, boy?
I don't know. I mean, I bought a single when I was very young. I was really into Cream, and the single that I had at the time was called Badge, and I brought it home, and my dad put it on. My family were never, you know, they didn't really acknowledge pop music, but he put it on the wrong speed because it was a single, and he just stuck it on, and it played at 33 RPM, and we're sitting there, it's going, really slow. My dad said, this is not so bad. And I'll never forget that moment because it's about the only time he ever acknowledged. But did I hear him speaking to me? I had a lot of people speaking to me because the classical music world is a loud chorus of voices. And so, but at the same time, I didn't. I switched it all out. I switched it out and just did my thing.
Didn't Arvo Pärt?
He said no.
He said no, didn't he? He didn't like you were using his... You did some of his
He didn't like anybody doing it. He controls everything. I don't mind. He's brilliant. He's a very, very religious man. I mean, he's a monk, basically, and he's very spiritual. And you don't just get to do a cover version of him. Whereas Goretzky was utterly brilliant, and he was so nice about it. Because we had to pull the first record and put it in a landfill because of Arvo Pärt, basically. Whereas Goretzky was brilliant. In fact, I went to Poland on a tour, and we were going to meet up. But then he was called away to France. So we got on the phone, and his... didn't have any English at the time. I didn't have any Polish, so we both spoke in what was basically schoolboy French, but enough to determine that he was just such a nice man and so amenable to it all. I don't have any bad feelings about Arvo Pärt, by the way, and I love his music. He just wasn't, you know, we should have consulted him first, that's all.
The irony is we now have Pete Tong sort of doing Ibiza classics with an orchestra at the Isle of Wight Festival.
Yeah. I've never conducted... Well, I have conducted. I mean, I conduct in the studio quite often, you know, just to keep the tempo, but I've never conducted in front of an orchestra. I'm amazed by conductors. I wrote a symphony and I went on a train to Manchester with the guy that was conducting, Alexander Shelley, amazing conductor. And he's got my score written out and it's this great chunk of page, you know, about a foot, 2 foot high, with all the parts written out that's been transcribed, because I can't read it. And he's just sitting on the train reading my score and nodding his head and humming. And I'm thinking, dude can actually read it and hear it in his head just looking at the page.
Yeah.
Well, and not just one part, all of the parts.
Yeah. Well, that's how classical musicians often, composers work. They just write it down, don't they? They don't even go to the piano. No. What's the plan with this album, though, William? Is it to take it out on the road?
Not this year, apart from I'm doing Docklands on September the 11th to do with Anjuna Deep. And I'm going to do a performance at Dolby Atmos headquarters in Soho Square on the in August. And that's probably about it this year. Next year, I think I'd love to hit the road. I might do a residency in Venice, because I've always wanted to do a thing when you turn up at the same club with the same crowd every week and develop a kind of rapport. And since I'm going to be living in Venice, I think I might do it there.
Guy famously played in Venice with Pink Floyd, didn't you, Guy?
Yeah. Where did you play?
Yeah. The Lido?
No. We had a giant North Sea oil barge and we put the Pink Floyd Stadium stage on it and we floated it out to the middle of the lagoon. And we were surrounded by basically every gondola in Venice was hired by people who parked up in front of the stage.
Oh, my God.
And then we had 200,000 people in San Marcos Square. And then we went out live to every country in Europe. You're probably not looking at something like that, though, are you?
Fuck it up.
That's kind of you to put it that way.
Guy, if that isn't an advert just to frighten every potential interviewee off, I don't know.
Well, it was nothing to do with me. I just turned up and played the bass. You know what I mean? I didn't build it.
Those gondolas, they're very skillful. I mean, I've got this back door in my house directly onto the canal, and it's the only way to, well, you could walk, but you're better off coming on. So people will literally come and go from my house in those little gondoli or a vaporetto or a speedboat, but by water, definitely.
If they wanted to get paid off, apparently they came to Steve O'Rourke, the manager, the head of the gondoliers union, and said, if you don't give us, I don't know, 100 grand or whatever, we'll all line up in front of the stage and blow our whistle. Like, you know, in front of the Pink Floyd PA, and Steve is just like, mate, give it your best shot.
And it's true that if you jump in one of those and you're English, the price is, you know, they do add a few noughts on.
But hang on, Guy, that actually also sounds like something Hypnosis might have charged thousands to direct and film.
Yes, exactly.
But I know we're going to let you go, William, but did you do some work with Richard Wright?
Yes, you did a remix for Richard, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Completely
forgotten. Because Richard was my father-in-law at the time.
Oh.
Sadly missed Richard. And he, but the funny thing was, because he was really baffled, because it was beautiful, the remix you did. And he was really baffled, going, but I don't understand, it's not my song. And we're going, no, we're having to explain what a remix was. And I realised what he was worried about was that he thought he'd had to give you publishing.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe he does, actually, retrospectively, now you mention it. No, of course not. And I was glad to, publishing. No, I was glad to do it. I tried to pay homage to it.
Yeah, no, it was a beautiful remix. We all loved it. And Gala, his daughter, loved it.
What is it, Guy? What was it?
I can't remember what the song was. It was a track off Broken China, his song.
Yes, that's right. I'm going to dig it out. I've forgotten about it completely.
Yeah.
I did meet Nick Mason briefly at the Groucho Club. I mean, I've been aware of Pink Floyd since Grantchester Meadows and everything.
Well, mate, we are going to play Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun tonight.
Oh, gosh.
And you famously did Set the Controls for the Heart of the Bass.
With Steve Hillage.
Which I presume is an homage. Yeah.
Yes, it was an homage, definitely. I think we had to pay them publishing, but, you know, that's as you do.
Really?
I can't remember. It doesn't matter. But, yeah, Steve Hillage, it was fun. Yeah, Set the Controls for the Heart of the Bass. And that's when I did call my band Bass-O-Matic, but that is when the bass started to be proper, you know. It's like, yeah. And by the way, you can get decent bass on vinyl, you just have to master it correctly and have decent plastic. Look at Mowax records, they pretty sound pretty bottom end.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you going to be doing any producing in the future now, do you think, or is it solo work you're thinking about most of
the time? I could see myself having an appetite. I haven't got the time right now, but I can see myself, yeah, I would, now that I feel like I could. I mean, I've made my own record, haven't I? I wouldn't mind doing some production. It can be as pop as you like. I would like to do that in about a month or two. Let's see if anybody rings me up. I haven't put the word out.
Well, your skill is that. You can do things that are very textural and art, and at the same time, you're willing to take on pop as well. And there's no shame.
Absolutely. I love a good pop song. I love to put myself in the service of an artist and help them to do what they do, and technically and everything. And I love to spend a lot of time working on the vocals. That's another happy place, working on vocals to get them just special. So, yeah, I probably should. I probably will. We'll see. Yes.
You should. Well, you absolutely should, William. I'm sure we'd all welcome you back with open arms.
We're going to say goodbye and thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. That was really enjoyable. Ian, Gary, Guy, that was so enjoyable. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cheers, William.
Thank you.
What a delightful chat. What a delightful chat.
Very, very nice, you know, and thoughtful. Yeah. And it's an extraordinary little kind of balance that he's able to play between art music and commercial music. You know, everything from, you know, on his new album, Katie Melua, to Beth Orton, you know, you can hear, and to African music, you know.
I think what's very important is that he can really separate himself as a writer and a producer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which a lot of people don't, you know, there are a lot of writer producers who will produce, but they kind of want to be writing.
What we never touched on, which is worth, if any of our listeners fancy going back, is his early band, Torch Song, which I think was a very early 80s.
Well, he was first signed to IRS in 1980, and he has a sort of, you know, post-punk start.
Yeah, but,
point, really.
But that sort of slightly German-influenced electronica that he was doing in the early 80s, which obviously wasn't that successful anyway. I mean, he was a man destined to be successful later in life, and in the 90s, it was made for him.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that thing, isn't there, that like 1956 is kind of the dream year to be born in terms of music, in terms of hearing everything.
Right, Guy, I have my Alpine horn, and it needs using.
You've got half an hour, and then I'm going to release the dogs. So you've got a good head start there up the hill.
And my lederhosen are just hanging up,
chafing,
waiting for me. Chafing.
My lederhosen are chafing terribly.
Right, and I'll be seeing you in a few minutes at soundcheck.
Well, you will. Good night from me.
And it's good night for him.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.